Okay, so I'm going to do something different. I'm going to give you some data, right? So I am one of the co-authors of the forthcoming report on CLABSI, central line associated bloodstream infections, together with Marion Kiner from the Tennessee Department of Public Health and Peter Pronovost from Johns Hopkins. And this has been one of the early pieces of the Healthy People 2020 report. So let's go. Let's see. What am I doing here? Why isn't page down working?
You have to click arrows.
Oh, click arrows. Ah, here we go. Okay. So some background on healthcare-associated infections. Your chances of getting one if you go to the hospital are in the 3-4% range. Your chances of dying if you get one are in the 4-5% range. So we probably kill 100,000 people a year through HAIs, and I mean that's a big number, right? Now they're not as young as auto accident victims, but this is a lot of people. Auto accidents kill 30,000. Direct health care costs, meaning the amount of extra health care spending, maybe $50 billion a year. The total cost, if you account for the value of life and morbidity, is several times that. CLABSI are one type of infection, but they're an important one. They're responsible for a significant fraction of the infections and an even larger fraction of the deaths, because these are serious infections. The mortality rate, if you get a central line infection, is on the order of 30%. Moreover, most of them are preventable. Maybe not absolutely all, but the vast majority are preventable. We have good clinical evidence on that from my co-author Peter Pronovost's work, among others. And we're just not preventing them, right? We're not trying hard enough. We know pretty well how to stop most CLABSI. It starts with something called the central line bundle, which consists of five relatively simple steps, right? One is use full surgical drape when you install a central line. Another is use chlorhexidine soap on the insertion site. A third is avoid the femoral artery in the leg, because that seems to be prone to infection. A fourth is take the line out when you don't need it. Don't leave it in place because you might need it again in a few days. This is relatively simple stuff, right? And yet we're not doing it. We're not doing it consistently. We're getting better inside ICUs, intensive care units. Outside ICUs, maybe we're getting better, maybe not. Nobody's actually measuring. Isn't that scary, right? We've started measuring CLABSI in ICUs, and we're still not really measuring them outside ICUs. And as we get better inside the ICUs, the ones we're not even measuring become a bigger portion of the total. Moreover, there's lots of variation in hospitals. Some hospitals pay attention. Other hospitals don't. Some hospitals pay attention for a couple of years and then slack off. Underneath this is a problem with financial incentives. CLABSI control is expensive. So for a major hospital, maybe $1 million a year, that costs money to the hospital, so they spend more, and in return they get less revenue because they don't get paid for treating their own infections. Right? Good for patients, good for society, not clearly so good for hospitals. That probably has a lot to do with why we're not trying harder. So the question here is, does public reporting help? Right? That's the law question, right? It would be nice to fix the incentives. Maybe one piece of fixing incentives is adding public reporting. And so, you know, about 25 states have state-specific laws requiring public reporting, and then the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services got in the act and required national reporting starting in 2011. And so what effect does public reporting have on infection rates? I want to say at this point, still unknown, right? And so we're trying to study this as part of this project, as part of my other research. On the one hand, you might think, well, if you measure something, you'll manage it better. Hard to imagine that you manage something very well if you don't even measure it. And if you have to measure and publicly report. You might get some patient and doctor pressure. You also might get some internal professional pride and more internal resources. One thing I think we're learning from the public reporting effort is the patients don't notice. The doctors don't notice. The senior hospital officials might notice if they get a high rate in a public report. Maybe similar to nutrition, telling the patients isn't the way to go. Not that it has no effect, but it doesn't seem to have much. You hear counterarguments, so you hear from infection preventionists, well, I'm spending so much time counting infections, I don't have time to prevent them. Maybe. No evidence, no real evidence yet that patients or doctors are using the data. Insurers might. That's perfectly plausible, but no evidence yet. Part of a broader context, right? U.S. healthcare is wildly expensive and of only middling quality. The general public view is it's expensive and good, but those who study it know it's only expensive. Can public reporting have any role to play in addressing those problems? Okay, so on to the data. I'm going to give you two sources of data, one from my own case study of Pennsylvania, which was an early state to require public reporting, where we find evidence that if you have public reporting, you have lower actual infection rates, in quotes, because we'd have no perfect measure of what's an actual infection. We also have evidence for gaming. Let me call it, a more polite term would be time inconsistent reporting, which is when you make hospitals report, they get better at not reporting their infections. And so I'll tell you what we try to do to measure actual rates, because we can't just rely on their reported rates. So here's what we try to do in the study. We're going to use inpatient data sets, and we're going to pull from these billing records, we're going to pull CLABSI out of the billing records. Now, is that a perfect source? No, it's not a perfect source. There will be some infections that aren't captured in the billing records. There will be some infections that are captured in billing records that weren't real infections. There isn't a perfect source, but I'll show you that it correlates pretty well with other sources of data about infections. The great advantage of looking at the inpatient data is that, so imagine you had a drug trial, right? You're going to do a double-blind randomized experiment. You want a treatment group and a control group, and you want data both before and after, right? That's what you want. If you have that, you can conduct a difference in differences design. You can compare the treated to the controls after versus before and see whether your drug had an effect, right? If you rely on public reporting of data, well, what do you have? Well, you have after and no before, and you only have reporting for the treated hospitals. That's not going to get you very close to a good research design. So the advantage of the inpatient data is we actually have it both before and after in both treated and control states. And then we can look for evidence of time and consistent reporting by comparing the inpatient data to the publicly reported data. So here's the inpatient data. Blue are the control states. Red is Pennsylvania. This is a one-state case study. Doesn't mean this happens in other states. We're in the process of trying to get data from the National Healthcare Safety Network so we can look at other states. But it sure looks like something was happening in Pennsylvania relative to control states. The red is Pennsylvania's inpatient infections in their billing records. The green is the public reporting. Okay, during 2005 to 2007, which is the only period where we have consistent data, and then they changed the reporting system. So somehow the green drops a lot more steeply than the red. The red does drop, but the green drops a lot more steeply, and I find that suspicious. Core concern with this project is we can call construct validity. Are we measuring what we think we're measuring? We're trying to measure infections, but we're pulling them out of billing records. Here's some evidence on that. So this is just comparing the inpatient infections from the billing records on the x-axis to the reported infections in the first year of reporting on the y-axis. And you see there's a really strong correlation between the two, right? There are a few outliers, which I put in red, but on the whole, we think we have an imperfect but decent measure. Okay, let me turn to the Tennessee experience provided by Marion Kiner. where they began reporting to the Tennessee Department of Public Health starting in the beginning of 2008. And for about a year and a half, nothing happened. Then the Department of Public Health sent an early version of their public report. So they collected data for a year. They spent some time putting it together. And in September of 2009, they released a private version to the hospitals with a public version to follow after there was a chance for error connection. Here's what happens. All right, so nothing happens until the public report gets released or released to the hospitals, and then the rates start to head down. Again, this is an anecdote, it's not data, but it sure is suggestive that if you tell the public that particular hospitals are doing badly, they might do something about it. Next lesson, the need to keep nudging. I'll describe what Tennessee does and ask the question how many public health departments do this. So their idea, Marion's idea, was we're going to tell each hospital how many infections they need to prevent to reach, you know, the overall goal, a number needed to prevent, and then the goal is going to move as you achieve general progress, and they're going to update quarterly. They're going to give each hospital a nudge, and then they're going to focus their attention and meetings on the big hospitals because that's where the payoff is. So here's an example of a report from a slide that Marion provided to a particular larger hospital. So the idea is in the middle you see the number needed to prevent, and so we focus on perhaps this hospital is actually doing pretty well. Okay, they're on their Tennessee goals. But others, they're not doing so well, right? And then the last column says, among the hospitals in our state, you're in the top five in the largest number needed to prevent. Well, of course, the bigger hospitals are more likely to be in the top five. So here's a particular hospital. I think it's the same one, though I don't know that. And this is what they were doing. In 2008, they were terrible. In 2009, they were terrible. By 2010, they're getting better, and then they start to focus, and they're actually now doing quite well. All right, these infections are preventable, and the question is, how do we get people to focus attention on preventing them? This is back to Pennsylvania, so this is a partial scatter plot of the bottom third of hospitals in reported rate, right? The middle third. So the bottom third is down here, right? Bottom third is here, middle third is here, top third is here. This is the change from 2005 to 2007. What you see is if you're doing well, you don't work very hard at getting better. If you're doing okay, you don't work very hard at getting better. And if you're doing badly, then something seems to happen. So the effect seems to be on the high-rate hospitals. That's perfectly plausible if you think about what the incentives are. You don't want a news story saying, your hospital is an outlier and has too many infections. So to conclude, at least preliminary evidence that public reporting leads to lower actual CLABSI rates. Pennsylvania, we saw maybe 20%, maybe 15%, but that's only 20%. We can do a lot better than that. We need more than public reporting to get where we'd like to be. Part of this is a threshold effect. It's really only the hospitals in the top third or top quarter that seem to pay attention and take affirmative steps. Now, if they go down, then what counts as the top third will start migrating down as well, but we're not seeing the efforts that we might like out of the hospitals that are already doing pretty well. And then some evidence for time inconsistent reporting, which suggests that we need some auditing of what the reported numbers are. And most states don't audit. So that's where I am. Thank you. Know that we should eat fruits and vegetables and fire and water, right? But not everybody does.
Hospitals only pay attention to infections, and some of them do, and some of them really do, and some of them sort of do. So in some sense, having the recommendation is not the problem. We know how to prevent sepsis. We know how to prevent lots of other infections, and we're not. It's not the recommendation. It's what's the stick? What's the incentive? How do you get hospitals to actually focus? How do you deal with, so Peter Fargo's view is out of the 4,000 or so acute care hospitals that we have, you know, maybe 80% are doing a decent job, but this is the 20% that aren't are responsible for a large share of the ICU CLABSI infection. There's also a measurement issue. We're simply not measuring CLABSI outside ICUs. So NISN, National Healthcare Safety Network, decided their job was to measure CLABSI in ICUs. We get reporting from ICUs. Nobody's reporting, nobody's measuring, nobody's counting, and my guess is not much is happening.
So here is an example. At home rectal swabs for STI testing have not been approved by FDA. In particular, considering like how STI disproportionately impact MSM and the link between STIs and HIV tests. So my question is how can we use the data, right? How can we use research, better use this research to actually impact policy? Have here something that could work, for instance, right? Rectal swabs at home. We know that works. We have a population in need, a vulnerable population, and this hasn't been approved by FDA, right? Once again, how can we better use research, best evidence-based practice to inform policy change and affect policy change? I know it's a broad question, but maybe you guys can talk from your own personal experience.
I'll take a shot. I think that's really the, for those of us who work in public health practice, and I don't know exactly what you do, but I can take a guess. I think, you know, that is the challenge, right? It's the translation of the research and the science, which is sometimes years and years and years in development, as Scott talked about, to actual implementation or impact in our communities. And whether it's policy change or it's program implementation, and I used to think it was more about sort of policy change, that's my training, but now that I'm in a job where I run programs too, you've also got to have the programming to go with the policy change, right? Because you can change the policy, maybe that can be a available test, but if there's no way to get it to the population in need, that doesn't necessarily mean that the policy change has done anything. So, you know, I think that's the leadership challenge probably for those of us in public health practice, and that's actually what I think it is a leadership challenge, and that can come from anywhere, but you have to have a champion for that kind of change as well, and I think that's very important that we are educating young and upcoming MPH students to be champions for that kind of change and to question some of that and think about what the implementation might look like. So that's just my, I don't know if anybody else wants to add.
So you're talking about, to make sure I understand this, FDA making a change in the...
Well, that was just an example, right? You have a community disproportionately impacted by an STI epidemic, pretty much, chlamydia gonorrhea, 22% prevalence rate. We know that rectal swabs is a mechanism to detect that, and at home rectal swabs haven't been approved by FDA. So I wonder, and we have the science, we have the evidence supporting the need for this. That was an example, right? And I wonder how research, evidence, can inform a policy change or a structural change.
I suppose that what I'm thinking about is that these are all, we have lots of different kinds of problems that we might easily collapse under the sort of recommendations banner, but that they're quite different. So, you know, there's a whole range of things that probably aren't that controversial and that policymakers could do. And you're just trying to get them to do it. You know, we often focus on the things that are controversial and it feels like we don't do anything in public health, but people pass law at all. So they start in the hospital. We just want to do the right one. Then you've got problems like yours, which is, you know, just one of the many buboes, if I may use the bubonic plague analogy, on the body of our drug access system. I mean, the FDA is not good at getting drugs to people, in my opinion. It's not good at moving quickly to make things easier. It's really about making things harder. And that may be good for us. I mean, there's certainly a lot of controversy right now about efforts to make drug approval easier. I'm not sure drug approval at some broad level. But, you know, this is just this is like the naloxone. It's like a lot of other areas where we have a drug that everybody knows works. It's been around for a long time. We've got something we can do. And forget about trying to get it to happen. Private sector, and they got to want to profit in it, and then the FDA's got to, you know, sort of, I don't know, get out of the way. So, you know, there I think we have classic, I mean, you know, it's really more like structural reform problems and less about, you know, recommendations.
I would say one thing, and since yours was an example kind of other things, another is really to think through how we package and how we bring the data and the evidence to people. I think you may say we know it works and we have percentages and what. Policymakers may want that one story. They need the data, but there may be a certain way that they would understand it better. So I think some of it really is also thinking through how you bring different information to different audiences. For some audiences, it might be it's worked in these three communities. For other, it might be here's the cost that you're going to be reducing by doing this. And so really just thinking, people always talk about elevator speeches and such, but kind of those different messages you're bringing different places, making sure that you know the evidence is good otherwise. And that story also brings you that audience to bring, as Scott and the team were saying, that pressure to bring people to start that discussion where FDA may say, gosh, this is so important, we need to look at it.
One of the questions I had to come up, so for your buddy, Colin, I actually just read his book, Safe Treatment Better Hospitals. So maybe when your presentation, I was thinking about that, like, that makes sense. But I guess my overall question is for the health care project, like, how did you guys determine, like, what topics to focus on from Hepatitis 2020? Was it the ones that, how your colleagues just said, the ones that are less controversial, or ones that seem like it was kind of low-hanging fruit? Because I'm just curious to know, from your other expertise, like, is more focused on, like, housing in the dual environment? Because we know that if you improve the environment, then everything else kind of falls into place as far as healthcare costs and the food environment. I'm just curious to know how to select your topic.
Great. So we have, you know, the groups we talked about helped us think through criteria for the reports. Knowing we're only doing 10 to 15 reports and there are 42 topics, unfortunately we're not going to be able to do all the ones we want. So there was a mix of that, you know, which topics do we think, one, there's an interest within the groups in, you know, in the field. That was one criteria. Another was which objectives do we think make a difference. We wanted to make sure we worked with a range of topics. I think built environment specifically is one that we have a lot of interest in doing, but another thing we have to look at are the objectives themselves in Healthy People 2020 and what data points we have, and which we also really wanted to make sure, not necessarily controversial, although we certainly looked at, is it a politically, you know, hot topic, or more importantly, is it a topic really exciting in the field that we think people would be interested in the information? But do we have that evidence base that we can tell people what works? And so those environments, I'm not saying it's not there, but those are kind of all criteria we use. Some of it also is, you know, topics, people that reached out to us and said within our federal partners were excited about making better reports. And so we also wanted to make sure we didn't tax one group kind of too much. So we're working with nutrition and weight status, which, for example, works with the lab, for example, at CDC with our chronic disease partners. We wanted to make sure all the reports weren't working on chronic diseases at CDC. So we're also making sure we work with different agencies and different partners. But certainly, built environment is a really exciting topic, and maybe one that we come back to. We just haven't gotten to.
All right, 9:59. Does anyone have a quick one? Good. Okay. Thank you all for being here. Please try and make it out.